Welcome to the History of Christianity podcast with Stephen Bedard. This episode is a part of a series of lectures that I gave for a course on Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels at Tyndale University College in Toronto. I encourage you to check out the webpage for that program, which is tyndale.ca/DCP. And also check out my webpage at historyofchristianitypodcast.com. And if you want to support this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/hopesreason and support in any way you are able. Thank you and God bless. So a few definitions for us to talk about. This course is on the Synoptic Gospels, so we need to talk what the Synoptic Gospels are. The name given to Matthew, Mark, and Luke because they present the ministry of Jesus from a similar perspective. Synoptic means viewed together. And so the reason why they are the Synoptic Gospels and not John is that if we put the four Gospels, and you can put all four in columns, you'll find that the first three, there's a lot of overlap. They're dealing with a lot of the same stories. Sometimes it's almost word for word the same. Now there's a few parts of John, like the feeding of the 5,000 that's found in the other Gospels. But a lot of the other stuff is just not there. John is in another world. Like, he's got a totally different tradition. So you can't easily compare him with what's going on in the other three. But the other three seem to be meant that you can read them both vertically, that is, say, from the beginning of the gospel to the end, but also horizontally, that you can look at a story in each of the three gospels. You can look at them together. So that's why they're called synoptic Gospels. Another definition that we need to be aware of is source criticism. We're going to talk about a number of criticisms, but the first one is source. So it's a type of historical criticism which seeks to identify the written sources behind each gospel and their relationship to one another. And this is what you're really going to get into in your take-home exam with the book on the four views of the synoptic problem. So we're going to look at what the synoptic problem is. But basically, source criticism is making an assumption that each of these Gospels had sources that they were using. Whatever that might have been, whether they were written sources, well, that's what the focus is on here. But you'll find in the book that you'll be reading, it also talks about oral traditions as well. But the assumption is they're using something. What are they using, and what is the relationship to each other? So here's just an example, and this is how we can look at the Synoptic Gospels. So this is, I'm not going to read it for you, but this is a passage that's found in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. And so we can put them side by side, and as we look at them, we see that there is some really close connections. There are some points where it's word for word, and then there are other times when it's a little bit different. And so the synoptic problem is basically asking, why, with these three Gospels, why is it that at some points they're almost exactly the same, and at some points there are some slight differences in wording or sometimes additional details given? What is going on? So that's the problem. It's not a horrible problem. It's a good problem. But we need an answer to that problem. And there are a number of ways to look at that. So our text, Mark Strauss, says that the question is the relationship between these three Gospels. Why do they so closely resemble each other? Why do they differ at so many points? Did they borrow material from each other? Which was written first? And which borrowed from the others? The questions of these relationships has been termed the synoptic problem. And so you're going to have lots of time to dig into that, but we're going to just introduce it a little bit here so that you're at least situated so that when you read the book on the four views, you'll be all ready. So the first step in the synoptic problem is to determine the earliest gospel. Okay, that's what we want to know. Of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, what was the first gospel that was written? Augustine, who lived 354 to 430, he understood it this way. Now, those four evangelists whose names have gained the most remarkable circulation over the whole world and whose number has been fixed as four are believed to have written in the order which follows. First Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, John. So he understood the order that's found in our New Testament, that must be the order in which they were written. And in some ways it was unfortunate that he said that. I mean, it's what he believed, so that's fine. But Augustine really believed that Mark was a summary of the Gospel of Matthew. That's how he described it. And so because of that, what you find in the history of Christian thought in terms of theology, but also preaching and all the other things that happened, we have hardly anything on Mark because no one cared. If you have the Gospel of Matthew and you have this kind of shorter summary version of it, you know, it's like Gospel of Matthew for dummies, you know, like that's how people saw it. Like, why would you preach for Mark? Why would you teach on Mark? There's no point. And it wasn't till really getting into like the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries that people got a renewed interest in Mark. And now Mark is one of the most popular Gospels to study. But anyways, that's what he thought. He made the assumption that Matthew was first. And one of the views in the Four Views book that you have deals with that. So as I said, Augustine believed that Mark was an abbreviated version of Matthew. Now, more recently, scholars come up with a different theory. Mark does not have as many stories as Matthew and Luke, but when they do have the same stories, Mark's record of it is a little bit longer. So, yes, Mark is shorter, but it's shorter because it has less stories, not because he summarizes the stories that are there. And so that has gotten some scholars thinking. And in content and style, Mark reads more like a first draft rather than the source text or an abbreviation of a fuller gospel. The Greek's a little bit rougher in Mark than it is in Matthew or in Luke. So today, the majority of New Testament scholars accept Mark as the earliest gospel. This is called the priority of Mark. The priority of Mark doesn't mean that Mark is more important. It means that it's believed that Mark was the first gospel that was written. Now, there are still people who believe that Matthew is. I don't think there's anyone who thinks that Luke was the first, and that wouldn't seem to make sense with the prologue of Luke. If there is a general consensus, it would be that Mark is, but you are welcome to argue that point, and be happy to hear that. So a part of the solution to the synoptic problem is that Matthew and Luke seem to have used Mark as a source. And so that is a pretty common understanding. They would say that relationship we see between Mark and Matthew and Luke, it looks like that both Matthew and Luke had a copy of Mark, and they used him. They copied his stuff. You know, they don't have to footnote, because they're not under the same rules that we are here. If you do what Matthew and Luke did, you will get in big trouble in this class, but they were able to do that, and that was common. However, there's still a problem, because there's a significant amount of material that is common between Matthew and Luke, but not found in Mark. So there's still this relationship going on between Matthew and Luke, but now Mark is out of the equation because it's just not found in Mark. So we have to figure out, where did they get that stuff from? And there's a number of explanations. The most common one, but this is only one of the four that you're going to look at, the most common is that the material that Matthew and Luke use comes from a sayings gospel. So a sayings gospel would be similar in style to the Gospel of Thomas that we saw. And they call this gospel Q. However, we don't have a manuscript of Q. So it's not like Thomas. At least with Thomas, we know that it existed. We have manuscripts. There might be a bit later, but we have manuscripts of Thomas. We know this thing existed. So we don't know for sure that Q existed. We don't know if it was just an oral gospel or if it was a written gospel. We don't know. But many scholars today, including evangelical scholars, this is not just a wild liberal theory or anything like that. Many evangelical scholars would accept this. They would say that Matthew and Luke had access to this other sayings gospel, and we just happened to call it Q.
And
not only did they have that, we still have a problem, because there's still stuff in Matthew that's not found in Luke. There's still stuff in Luke that's not found in Matthew. So where did that come from? Well, we call the stuff that's unique to Matthew M, and the stuff that's unique to Luke, we call that L. Really creative. Mark, obviously, is made up all of Mark. Matthew is made up of part of Mark, and then part of Q, and then part of M, and Luke is made up of part of Mark, part of Q, part of L. That's a really simplified version. So sometimes this is called the two-source hypothesis. Sometimes it's called the four-source hypothesis. When we say it's the two-source hypothesis, we're saying Mark and Q. When we call it the four, we're using M and L in there as well. But they're the same thing. The two-source and the four-source are the same thing. And that is the most common explanation for the synoptic problem. But it's not the only one. And so that's going to be your job to work through that. Aside from Q and not knowing if Q existed or anything like that, what are the theological implications for inspiration? If, as Christians, we believe that God inspired the New Testament or the Bible in general, what does that look like if Bible writers are using sources? Does that mean that the original source was inspired? Does it mean it became inspired when it was brought into the Gospels? And the Christian understanding of inspiration is very different from the Muslim understanding of inspiration. Because for Muslims, the Quran existed long before Muhammad ever existed. In fact, before Jesus, in fact, before Abraham. In fact, there are some Muslims who say that the Quran is co-eternal with Allah, that there was never a time that the Quran didn't exist. And the Quran was just revealed to Muhammad. So even though it's describing events, and it's describing events about Muhammad, and it's describing events about Jesus and about all these other people, they would say that that already existed forever. There wasn't a time. It just came. And that's why, in terms of the Quran, when they were compiling the Quran, there actually was textual differences from different manuscripts, which is a big problem if the Quran is co-eternal with God, right? So they destroyed them. They picked one version, and they destroyed all the other stuff. So they point at Christians and will say, well, you know, you have such an unreliable Bible, because look at, you have all these textual problems. You know, we pick in our New Testament, the footnotes will say some manuscripts say this or some manuscripts say that. You can't trust it. But that's because they destroyed all the other ones. I mean, we could do that too, yeah. Right? If we want to just pick one and then we'll destroy everything else. But that's cheating. So we're not going to do that. So, in the Old Testament too, actually, we find that there are references to sources. Like when you read through the Kings, it'll say, you know, the Chronicles of this person or the Kings in Judah or Israel or whatever. Though that's not the Book of Chronicles that's in our Old Testament. It's referring to something else. We don't have those sources anymore. But you can see in the Old Testament that where they'll actually say, this comes from that, right? And I think one of the best passages for wrestling with this is Luke himself. This is what he says. Many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as the original eyewitnesses and servants of the word handed them down to us. It also seemed good to me, since I have carefully investigated everything from the very first, to write to you in an orderly sequence, most honorable Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things about which you have been instructed. So it looks like Luke is saying, I've done research. You know, there's eyewitnesses out there. There are other accounts that have been written. I have sorted through this kind of stuff, and I'm trying to put it all together to have a nice orderly sequence of the events. And this is the same kind of prologue that we find in other histories from that time. Other, like Thucydides, the Greek historian Thucydides, you know, he'll talk in this way. And Josephus himself will talk in this way about the sources that he uses, that he investigated certain things. And of course, every historian says they're doing it the proper way. And so that's what Luke is doing. He's acknowledging that he's using these things. He's aware of earlier accounts, and he's willing to use them. So there's no problem with Luke using Mark and whatever else he used, whether that be Q or one of the other theories that's there. However, there is a problem that some people will mention. Why would Matthew, who was one of the 12, use Mark, who was not one of the 12? Some people have, and this particular people who would hold to the priority of Matthew, so they would say that Matthew is earlier, they would say that seems really unlikely that Matthew would copy from a non-apostle when he was an apostle of Jesus. The tradition is that Mark does contain eyewitness testimony. And when we look at Mark next week, we're going to get into more detail about that. But the tradition, and it's a very early tradition, is that Mark's gospel is based on the preaching of Peter. And Peter was considered to be a much more important apostle than Matthew. So it does not seem unlikely at all for him to use it. But there's something else to remember. These apostles, Greek is not their first language, right? Aramaic is their first language. So if Matthew is writing his gospel and Greek is not his first language, but he's writing it in Greek, and there's already a Greek account of Jesus based on Peter's eyewitness account, what would you do? Would you write it all out original again in Aramaic and then translate it all into Greek? No. You cut and paste. And you just change things a bit, right? That's what goes on. That would totally make sense for a person whose first language is not Greek to use an already Greek source. This is why they're using the Septuagint. Instead of going to the Hebrew and translating it back into Greek, since you're writing in Greek, you copy what's in Greek. You know, you work smart, you don't work hard. That's the way it's supposed to be. A few other definitions that we have to look at. Textual criticism. So this is a study of manuscripts to determine the earliest and most accurate version of the text. So the problem we have, and it's a good problem, but the problem we have is that we don't have like a really early full Greek New Testament of like one book that has everything in it. That's just not what happens. Really, when you look at our manuscripts, we might have like a half of Matthew here, 3/4 of John here. We might have all of Luke Acts over here. And then there's a half of Revelation here, a third of 1 Thessalonians over here. And so we got all of these different manuscripts. Some of them are very small. Some are just like one chunk like this. In fact, our earliest manuscript is a chunk of Gospel of John, probably from about 120 AD, and it's only about that big. And so we have to sort through this and put it together. And there are differences in the wording. There are some things that are additions that have been added in. So sometimes what happens is that you have someone copying, and you know how maybe in your Bible you might write notes? I have a Bible that has columns that you can write little notes in there. That happened. Sometimes those notes made it into the text of the Bible. There's other mistakes that get in there in that there was one. Whoever was copying it couldn't actually read the language. So what happened, there was two columns, but the guy didn't realize it was two columns because he didn't read the language, he just copied. So we would read that column and then this column, right? He just copied across like this. So you can imagine what would happen. It's a mess. But he didn't know, so that's what he did. But we have so many manuscripts that we can sort through that stuff with no problem. And there's not even a competition between what we have for the New Testament and anything else. So like Plato, Herodotus, any of the Greek, Roman writers, I mean, it's not even close. We have thousands and thousands of manuscripts, and we can put it together so well that there's just no doubt. Yeah, there are some things we have, you know, we're not quite sure, but usually it's, you know, does the definite article belong? So, you know, like the, is it, should that be there? Sometimes it's the spelling of a name that we're not quite sure about, but everything else is so good that it's just, it's incredible. And they're still discovering New Testament manuscripts, early New Testament manuscripts, all the time. So it's great stuff. So that's what textual criticism is about. Then there's something called form criticism. It's a type of historical criticism which studies the oral or spoken traditions behind the written gospel sources. So form criticism would be things like, is this a miracle story? Is it a parable? Whatever, you know, something like that. We can determine what it was. So there's theories that maybe there was a collection of miracle stories that were around, and there was a collection of sayings that were traveling around before they actually got written down. Redaction criticism, a type of historical criticism which studies how the gospel writers edited their sources to achieve their distinct theological goals. So I said that when you put the synoptic gospels together, you can see that there are differences. And the question we have to ask is, why are there differences? Now, it could be simply a matter of style. I said that Mark is a little bit rougher. Maybe Matthew and Luke just wanted to pretty it up a little bit, right? And just make the style flow nicer. But maybe they had a theological reason for something. So, as we're going to find out next week, where Mark and Luke say the kingdom of God, very often Matthew says the kingdom of heaven. So why? Is it just he liked the ring of kingdom of heaven? Sounded nice? Or was there something else? Was there another reason behind that? So the best thing to do is when you hear redaction means editing, okay? Redaction means editing. And they did edit. So it's not, I joked about cut and pasting, but it's not as simple as that of cutting and pasting. They were theologians. They were literary creators who were purposely bringing the material together in the way that they did. So it's pretty important stuff. Okay, so one of the things we're looking at is the historical Jesus. Now, what is the historical Jesus? Historical Jesus is meant to be the Jesus who actually lived. So some people will differentiate the historical Jesus from the Christ of faith, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but they'll say that the historical Jesus is just, if you went in a time machine, you went back to the first century, and there's this guy named Jesus of Nazareth walking around, that's the historical Jesus. So they would separate that from Jesus as the second person of the Trinity, or the Son of God, or the raised Messiah, or anything like that. Now, I would want to push back a little bit on some of that, but let's start with the first quest, okay? So this is late 1700s to the early 1900s. The first quest was an attempt to be historical by noting how the scriptural accounts were not coherent and then seeing what remained. The argument grounded in excessive rationalism was that one should separate the document in the account from its historical core if any remained. So the best way to get an introduction to this is Albert Schweitzer's The Quest of the Historical Jesus, which is a really good book, really helpful to see the development of New Testament studies, especially in Germany. But what was happening, this is coming out of the Enlightenment. So in the Enlightenment was this radical change in how people thought, and it was a focus on rationalism, that basically human intelligence could answer everything, and we could put aside the superstitions of the past and just use our minds to reason through everything. And so part of that was to look at the Gospels and say, okay, yeah, Jesus still seems to be pretty important, but we know that miracles don't happen. We know that there's no supernatural. We know that people don't get healed. We know that people don't rise from the dead. So let's remove all of that supernatural junk, and let's get back to who the historical Jesus was. What was this person? And so this first quest was about these people peeling back all of the legends and the myths and everything else and trying to get to just the human Jesus, the one who really lived. And it pretty much was a failure, because every person who did that and tried to make this life of Jesus, their Jesus ended up looking just like them or what they valued, which is not a surprise that would happen. So you would think the next one would be called the second quest, but most often it's called the new quest. So the second questers make much use of many of the critical methods, such as form, redaction, especially tradition criticism. They do so usually requiring the burden of proof to fall on the need to show authenticity. This approach is the one which the Jesus Seminar falls. So the Jesus Seminar was this organization of New Testament scholars, all who happened to be on the very liberal side. And what they did is they gathered together and they voted on what Jesus really said. And so what they did is they had four different color marbles, okay? So red would mean Jesus really said it, you know, for the words of Jesus in red, so that would make sense. Pink would be he might have said it. Gray would be he probably didn't say it. Black would be he absolutely did not say it. So they published a book of the five Gospels, and each line, each saying of Jesus is in a different color, and you can look, and they will say they had voted that, yeah, Jesus did not say this, Jesus did say this, he might have said that, and that's what they did. But it definitely, they thought, unless there's a good reason to expect that Jesus said it, he probably didn't. So it's very pessimistic in terms of the historical value of the Gospels. But more encouraging is something called the third quest, and that's really what we're in right now. This emphasis on Jesus' Jewish roots grew up into what is becoming known as the third quest, an approach that runs alongside the second quest, but works more seriously with Jewish backgrounds than either of the earlier quests. In general, those who participate in the third quest have tended to see far more historicity in the Gospels than either of the previous quests, showing a renewed respect for the general historical character of the Gospels. And all three of these quotes are from Daryl Block. He has a great little book on sources for the historical Jesus. So yeah, the emphasis here is definitely on the Jewish side. So there was, in the New Quest, they looked a lot at Greco-Roman traditions, but now there's been a sort of a renaissance in looking at Jesus in his Jewish context, and that's really helping us to see things much clearer. And there is a lot more optimism about the Gospels. Now, there are some critical scholars in the third quest who would say that Jesus didn't do certain things, and that there would be certainly plenty of people in the third quest who would deny that Jesus rose from the dead or anything like that, but it's a lot more than what we've seen in the previous two quests. So that's something to be aware of. Some of the tools that these historians are using, because you have to remember, they're not coming at the gospel saying, well, I already believe that it's inspired by the Holy Spirit, so therefore it's accurate, and so here it is. We just take it. That none of them are coming from that perspective. Even the evangelical scholars, even though they might believe that personally, because they're working in history, they have to work with the tools that are available to them. So I'm just going to share a few of these tools. I'm not going to share all of them. But anyways, this one here is the criterion of dissimilarity. And the basic idea of dissimilarity, if there is a saying of Jesus that is too similar to the Judaism of his day, or is too similar to early Christianity, then it probably doesn't go to Jesus. Because if it's too Jewish, it probably was an existing Jewish saying. If it's too Christian, it's an invention of the church that has put back into the mouth of Jesus. Now, what's the problem with that? One of the problems is, what culture did Jesus come out of? Jewish. So is it really completely unbelievable that he would say things that sounded Jewish? The other question is, what religion is Jesus the head of? Christianity. Is it really unbelievable that maybe the early Christians wanted to use his teachings? I really have a problem with dissimilarity. It just is not, I think, a very helpful criteria for authenticity. But anyways, what they'll do, the way some historians will do something, they'll look at something and they'll say, so here's an example. The Son of Man. Jesus describes himself as the Son of Man. Well, within the Judaism of his day, that's not really used very much at all. It's not a major theme within Judaism. So it doesn't sound all that Jewish. And the early church really didn't pick up on the title Son of Man in their early worship and liturgy. So it doesn't sound too Jewish. It doesn't sound too Christian. So probably Jesus describing himself as the Son of Man, that goes back to Jesus. That's how the criterion of dissimilarity works. But that leaves you with very little, and I don't think it's very helpful. More helpful, I would say, is the criterion of multiple attestation. So basically, if you think about it in modern terms, you know, there's a car accident. What does the police officer do? Talks to witnesses. They don't just talk to one. The more that they can hear, the better. Now, what happens, though, if you have all those witnesses standing together and they're overhearing each other and they're just repeating each other? Well, then you're losing some of the usefulness of that, right? You want to have independent witnesses. So it is more complex than saying, well, this story is found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So there we go. We have four witnesses. Because it might not be. There might be a story that, say, that's found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but it is a story that's found in Mark that both Matthew and Luke are now copying. So that's considered one witness only. Now, if that same story is found in John is independent of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that's okay. The institution of the Last Supper, right? That's found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but it's also found in Paul in 1 Corinthians. So that's a witness for us. There are times where it seems that maybe Matthew and Luke are sharing a version of the story, but there's an independent version of it found in Mark. Or the death of John the Baptist. It's found in our Gospels, but there's an independent tradition of the death of John the Baptist in Josephus. So that's good. So that's how it all works out. We have to be careful. It's not just about counting how many times we find it in the text. It's rather how many independent versions of that. But, I mean, that's not perfect either, because in any history, you could have something inaccurate repeated, and in the same way, you could have a factual event only given once. So it's not perfect, but it's one of the things historians do. Another thing is called the criterion of Semitisms. So there's Aramaic or Semitic background that is used. So an example of that would be when Jesus is in the garden and he prays Abba, Father. Abba is Aramaic. That's probably going back to the historical Jesus. There are a few other passages when Jesus raises the little girl, says Talitha Kum. That is Aramaic. So that's probably evidence of historical authenticity, but the rest of it's written in Greek, so that doesn't really mean that the others are inaccurate. And then we have divergent traditions so these are things that are moving in different areas that a gospel is just sharing stories without them necessarily working towards the same pinnacle, and that might be an example of something that is accurate.